Hey guys, thanks for answering my questions about the San Diego Padres. I would like to ask Nick some questions because I'm a huge fan.
Of what?
You.
Of you.
Oh, cool.
Number one, could you give a brief summary of the work you did in archaeology and how did your career path unfold after that?
This may be a stalker.
Man, you insulted this person like five times. And
that's what
fan.
I do. That's what I do.
They're your fan.
It's the Dennis system. For any, it's always sunny in Philadelphia fans out there. Okay, so I got my history and archaeological degrees at the same time. During that time, I volunteered for a lot of the professors and did a lot of lab work. And I started sitting in on a lot of the master's classes as well, but I never got my master's in archaeology. Basically, a friend of mine from one of my classes was like, hey, like I have some work. Would you like to come join this this company that's affiliated with Tennessee? And I was like, sure. And so I joined a CRM firm that was affiliated with the University of Tennessee. And that was in 2005. And I worked for them through 2011. And I did a lot of field work as well as around 2007, we decided to do GIS, which is geographical information science. And we started mapping all of the archaeological sites through GPS and gradiometers and things like that. And it's a long process. It was just a really eye-opening experience. And I loved it. I got to go to China and France and lots of other places to do some cool archaeological digs. Then the economy turned to shit. And I had a couple rough years there where I worked for Best Buy and sold insurance and then got my master's degree. And now life is back on top.
I got a question for you.
Sure.
When you're digging, you're basically digging up someone's grave, right?
Not always, no.
But it's a lot of it, that's what they do. They find, oh, look, we found this prehistoric, whatever, this body or something like that buried under like 500 years ago. Would you be okay if someone came and dug up your grave? Like if 500 years from now, someone came up and said, hey, I want to find out what Tennessee looked like in 500 years ago.
Well, 90% of archaeological work is pre-construction. So if you have a building that's going on a piece of land that's never been built on or a bridge that's going over a river that's never been built on,
okay,
you legally have to check if there's anything of importance on that land.
Right.
And my six years that I did archaeological work all the time, I only found one body. And it was from a woodland period, Native American. It was around 1180.
Where at?
It was in Greene County, Tennessee. I'm not sure what the town was.
Did you find the body or is your...
One of my coworkers found it.
Okay.
I wasn't too far from it. I was digging on a different feature.
Are you just digging at random or you have like a sologram, whatever those things are called, the technical terms?
Yeah, okay. You have phase ones, phase two, and phase threes of archaeological work. Phase one is basically you do post-hole digging and you see little spots and then you go through like a screen. And if you find something in that screening, then you dig more holes around that one hole you dug.
Okay.
And if you find more of that, then you go to phase two, which is where you get a backhoe and you dig one trench. And if you find a significant, then you go to phase three, which is the whole excavation of the entire site. Most of the time, you rarely get out of phase two if you go anything. This one in particular was in 2009 that I'm thinking of when we found the body. It was a bridge that was getting built. They're building a new bridge right next to the old bridge. And most Native American sites are going to be a lot of stains. That's all you're going to find is stains from where a tent used to be or where a fire was burned. And so you just find you'll find regular clay and then like those little circles of dark clay. And that's where like a wood post had been put in the ground or where a fire had burned. It changed the coloration of the soil.
How long does it take? Because I know you can't just go in there with a backhoe and start. How long does it take to dig around? Because you got to be careful, right?
Yeah, you do. It's very. It depends on how big it is and how big the site is. Because you won't always totally excavate a site. A lot of times you'll just do where they're putting in construction and then you stop. Because the thing about archaeological sites is even if you find a famous one, you will always leave portions of it untouched. Because technology is only at the way it is right now. And who's to say in 10 years or 100 years, technology could be so much better to tell you something better historically. And so you don't want to take everything out because once it's out of the ground, it's out forever. And you're never going to get that evidence back or what's there. Yeah, I mean, it's a fun field for anyone that's really interested out there. You just don't get paid a lot. I would recommend you actually get a different career. And then when you retire, then get into it if you want to get into it, like when you're 50 or so. It's fun. It's different. If you're going to make money in archaeology, you basically need to get your PhD. And the average age of getting your PhD in archaeology is 45 years old. So it's, yeah, You get your undergrad at around 24. You get your master's, the average is, I guess, 30 or 32. And then your PhD is around 45. It's just a different kind of discipline. And it's more of a apprentice system to where you're under one professor who already, and you're basically copying his work and learning from him and writing his papers, and you get co-authorships. It's not like other programs where you just do your own thing and you graduate your own pace. It's completely different.
Jay, with the rest of the email.
All right. So, two, what is the most intriguing thing that you find about the Civil War?
Okay. That's a really interesting question. I find that the Civil War, more than any other thing in the history of the United States, defined this country. It changed the total trajectory of where we went as a nation. Because if you look at everything before the Civil War, you have a very limited government. You have a more of a, each state was considered almost its own country and its own sovereigning thing. And that's the way the South thought of itself, is like, we're an independent union of just, we're a confederacy. And that's in the truest sense of the way that like Switzerland is a confederacy of little bitty counties or districts. And the central government is fairly weak. And that's what the government was intended to be for the United States as well. The thing about New England, though, is that you have a bunch of really small states to where the culture is wall one culture. And so it's a bit different. But then with Lincoln being elected, and he wasn't even on the ballot in the South, and then the fact that the Republicans were threatening the spread of slavery, and I'm not endorsing slavery, everyone knows it's wrong. People decided, like, okay, we're going to become our own country because we're clearly not represented anymore by the views of the people in the North. And then Lincoln chose to expand the political powers of the executive branch to, you know, he got rid of a lot of rights in order to preserve the Union. And from that point on, the president of the United States has assumed more and more and more powers. And it's a trend that has sometimes been good, because you look at the stuff that Teddy Roosevelt did. But then there's been times where it's been really bad. And so it's a fascinating time.
You got the Revolutionary War, or the Civil War. Which one do you find more fascinating?
Well, I mean, I'm biased because that's what I majored in. So, yeah. I mean, the Revolutionary War is interesting. It's interesting the fact that, like, the way it's taught now to kids is that the Revolutionary War was, you know, the whole country wanted independence and that the British were evil, when in fact the people who actually wanted independence was actually a minority. The way the British teach the Revolutionary War to the English society is not, you know, the fact that they were oppressed in the United States. It's more of, what did we do wrong politically to drive the colonies away from us? And, you know, and that's the thing, like, that's what's great about history, is that there's never it's not black and white, it's very gray, and there's always two sides of it. So when people talk about history in absolutes, often they're wrong. Because that's what's, you know, that's how you can tell an intelligent person, is the fact that it's like, if I feel strongly about something and you feel strongly in the opposite way, you should make a debate or make a case to that other person if they're open-minded. And you might just change their opinion. You might educate that person to some other reason. I mean, I love people like that who disagree with me.
I got to agree with you on that one.
There you go. Last one. And do you think you have a fear of commitment/attachment? I know I did.
Yeah, I think everybody does. When I was younger, absolutely. I was scared to death in my early 20s of attachment and commitment. And I still do that. Like, I don't like people who move really fast. And, you know, like, I've met so many people that's literally they've gone on two dates. And then the next thing they know, the girl moves in with them. So I've only met a handful of girls that I really was like, wow, you're awesome. You know, like, we'd get along in discussions and things like that. And so I'm just one of those beliefs, like, when you meet the right person and when you're ready, they'll come along. Yeah, I've never been a needy person, and I've always been such an independent person that it does sometimes freak me out that I think that people have expectations of me, and I'm like, I don't like that. But, you know, I don't really, like the girl that I'm seeing right now, I have no worries with it. It's like, you know, if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But, you know, you always hope for the best. So, I mean, as I've gotten older, I've gotten a lot better. I had a lot of anxiety issues when I was in my early 20s. And I think it took me a little while to get a little more comfortable with myself.
Who has a question for Nick?
What movie would you say best on Civil War? I really like Glory a lot. Oh, no. Glory is actually really accurate, except for the fact that the Union soldiers were actually all college-educated free black men. And for some reason, they changed it to where they were all escaped slaves. I don't know why.
No, there was one.
That's true. The volunteer that was the best friend. But the entire 54th Yeah, the 54th. Yeah, the entire 54th was all free educated men from Massachusetts. I also like Gettysburg a lot, the TNT movie that they made in 93. Gettysburg is a great movie. His son, the author of that, he died, and his son wrote the other two books that were the prequel and the final one, and they just weren't as good. He took a lot from other sources, and he played too much on the history part of it, and that it just wasn't as – the characters just – it wasn't as good. But,
What about Patrick Swayze's North and South?
Oh, God, that movie – that series drives me nuts. Your favorite Cheers actress?
Kirstie Alley.
Kirstie Alley. If you watch that series, North and South, and you do not want to strangle Kirstie Alley, then you're more of a saint than I am. I mean, that she drives me nuts in that series. And I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the Civil War is that you literally have brothers fighting each other. You have friends, neighbors fighting each other. Yep. They spoke the same language. There's so many times and so many stories I've read of the soldiers, the regular day privates, going into the other camp and playing cards or trading tobacco for coffee or whatever and just talking to each other because they knew they had nothing to gain or lose in the war other than their lives. Right. And it was all up to the generals and the politics because that's all war is, people, is politics by other means. The thing that's also interesting about the Civil War out there, if anyone really wants to get into it, is it's the last war. It's the last American war where letters were not censored by the U.S. military. And so if you read letters from or journals or anything from Civil War, you will get a perfect description of what it's like to be in a war. Whereas in everything else after the Spanish-American War, which didn't last that long anyway, War One, War Two, everything is censored, and you could, because it's giving information possibly to the enemy, so they censored everything. But the Civil War is the last time where that, you know, you can read and get an actual accurate description of a war. I think that's why people get upset too when people don't stand for the anthem or they burn the American flag. It's like, because I mean, even though you have the right to do those things, and I would defend those people's rights to do it because I believe in the Constitution and the freedom of speech, but it's just the same thing. It's like, I've never ever felt our country has been that shameful or done something that just God awful, purposely God awful something to where I was like, you know what? I'm going to burn our flag right now. Because it's like, no, I mean, think about how many good things our country has done too. And so you're disrespecting it. And I understand why people do what they do, but I've never had that train of thought where it's like, I'm going to go that so far not to stand right. or not.
I'm going to throw this at you. What happened when, sure. if you were alive when Lincoln came marching in?
Look, I mean, that's a podcast to itself.
Okay. Damn you, Abraham Lincoln.
Lincoln was probably a really good guy. He probably was. But the things that he did, so many unconstitutional things he did because he wanted to keep the country whole. He set the standard for every president after that to abuse the power of the executive branch. I mean, people talk about like why was the Civil War fought. The argument that really needs to be had, but people don't always want to change it to their point of view, and which I'm going to do right now. Yes, the Civil War was motivated by the existence of slavery, which is true. The states seceded, at least the Deep South, the reason why they seceded was to keep the institution of slavery alive, true. But then Lincoln refused to acknowledge that they became their own country. That's a lot of the Southern argument, is that they were their own country at that point. Lincoln refused to acknowledge that a state has the right to secede. Therefore, he called upon an army to invade those states that were now in rebellion, according to him. They thought they were their own country, so he officially declared war on the South, and then that was what caused North Carolina, Virginia, Tennessee, and Arkansas to secede as well, because Lincoln decided to invade. So it's all in the point of view and how you look at it. That's a whole argument, and it's probably a boring thing to talk about on the Married Man podcast, but
Could he have ever gotten a second term?
No. Well, the thing is that, you know, he imprisoned so many people without a trial. He deported people that were against his point of view. He did so many things like that, that if it was covered like it is today, he couldn't have gotten away with a lot of things he did. And I mean, the thing is, people forget that there's two things. Like, Southerners who think that we actually had a chance of winning that war are crazy, because the North never fully committed to it. You know, it was just like, oh, we have to force people. The North had to force people to fight because, like, no one cared. No one was like, why would we want to fight to bring these states that want to leave? Like, no, but Lincoln was determined to do it. A lot of the North voted against Lincoln. I mean, they didn't want the war anyway. I mean, General McClellan was his opponent in 1864. And, you know, he almost won that election. it just so happened that the tide of the war had changed by that time to where he actually won the next election. But I really would have wished he wouldn't have been assassinated, because I in history's point of view, I would have been interested to see what he would have done with Reconstruction, because Andrew Johnson, even though I think he was right constitutionally and not allowing Republicans at the time to do all the harsh punishments they wanted to do on the South, Lincoln would have had a much softer way of doing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, because out of Reconstruction, that's where you get, you know, the KKK, Jim Crow laws. You get a lot of this stuff that shouldn't have happened because of just the bitterness. The museum I'm working part-time in right now, I'm in the bodies exhibit. And yeah, it's I think it's like 12 guys all from China, and they're all just down to either half muscle system or bone systems, and it's everything. And then of course everybody comes in there, especially little guys that are like between 10 and 13. They just point at penises nonstop and just giggle. Like, ah! You know? Yeah, I think with these guys, they're all from China. I think they were all former prisoners, and they donated their body to benefit their families after they died, because you know it's not really a wealthy country, so they kind of. Their last wish was to help them by doing this. Because that's like the number one question we get is, why is it all men? And that's the only reasonable thing you can think of. It's like, oh, they must have been all prisoners.
We were debating before you came on if you were dating your doctor.
Ooh.
Were you on a date? So we figured, well, maybe you're dating your doctor.
Wait, oh. She's a middle-aged Asian woman. So I'm this is my first meeting with her. And I'm actually quite happy with her, because if you want to stay healthy, the Asian women are going to get after you. Like, you know, looking at all my results, she's like, you don't take care of yourself. You need to, you know, like, I'm like, oh, she's going to be a ball buster. I like it.
Is she an endocrinologist?
Yeah. And like the thing is that where I went, it's called the City of Hope, which is just east of Pasadena. And because like someone recommended it, because it's a really good facility. And most of their people are actually leukemia patients. So it's actually, I remember the first time I ever went into any of these, when I was diagnosed and I went in for the first time, and I'm thinking this is going to be all diabetes people, but you don't know that when you've never been to an endocrinologist before. And it's just all these people that look terrible. And you're like, oh my God, like, is this what I'm going to look like in 5 years? I mean, I didn't know. And, yeah, exactly. Most of them had, you know, really bad, you know, thyroid conditions. Yeah, I'm a natural smart ass. So like, you know how it is, like the Jerry Seinfeld episode or a skit where, you know, he was talking about, what is it when you go to the doctor's office? They make you wait for a half hour. Then they call your name and make you wait for another half hour in another room.
What's the deal with that?
So the woman takes me back. It's the nurse or whatever you want to call them. And she starts doing all the measurements and weights and all that. And then she looks at me and she goes, I now need to ask you some questions. I was like, okay. She's like, are you abused at home? And I just kind of look at her. I'm like, I think her actual question was, does your spouse or girlfriend physically abuse you? And I looked at her and I smiled and I went, yes, she does, but it's okay. I enjoy it.
Yeah, you said that? Just,
yeah. And she just looks at me and she's like, okay, you're going to be with those people. No, she'd ask me about my mom. That could have been a whole – she actually did, because we have people you can talk to if that's just true. And I'm like, no, it's okay. And then the rest of them were fairly normal, but she was like, you know, can you hear me? I was like, what? And then two more down the line, she's like, do you have memory problems? And I said, what did you just say? Like, I was just being the biggest dick to her, like, every question. You know, the thing is that, like, usually that kind of stuff tends to hurt education, though, when they say, like, oh, the tax revenue from this is going to go towards education, because that means the state usually will defund other things, because it's like, oh, we're generating money from this now, so we can take away from this. When I went to college in 99, first undergraduate degree, it was a little under $300 per class. And then I think in 04, they passed the lotto bill in Tennessee to where like it would help with scholarships. The state immediately started defunding stuff towards universities. And so, because they were relying on those lotto money, and so it really didn't do anything. It just made the cost go up. Because by the time I got my, I didn't pay for it because the university paid for it, but my third degree, it was roughly, I think, $970 per class.
How many degrees do you have?
Four.
Four, okay.
Three undergraduates and one master's. Well, I'm saying it's one of the things that really is crazy about the South. Why would you not legalize pot? It's because like the 1/3 of all the pot that's already in this country is grown in West Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Kentucky. But it's all illegal in those states. Well, like one, the reason why college is so more expensive now is that, you know, up until I think the mid-70s, early 80s, you know, the state government would fund usually about 60% of all college money. But then because of lotto and a lot of other things and just government spending, they've lowered it now to around 28 to 35%. So like you look at how much the money the state now provides to universities, we're paying now more. We're paying up for the difference in the money. That's why it costs so much more. Mm-hmm. But now, that's what I was going to talk about. Is that the main reason for college now is no longer to get an education, really, because as long as you can do research now, you can do it on the internet and learn just as much in 5 seconds as you can from a semester at some bullshit university. The main reason to go university or grad school or whatever is connections. That's the only reason. Because I got my first two undergraduates, and they're practically worthless to me. My third undergraduate was the university paid for, and then my master's degree. The people that I met in both those programs are the people who got me my job, or the people who I learned things from.
You have four degrees?
I have 4 degrees, yeah.
Oh, my God. What are they in?
My first two are in history and archaeology, because I was an archaeologist for a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. And then while I was doing archaeology, I got into GIS, which is map making, but it's do computerized map making, things like that. But I mean, cartography is a fun skill, but basically you take GPS units, a lot of other things, and I was making data, and so I was making computers. So I went to grad school for it, and then this is what I'm doing now, but I'm making all the maps for, you know, of gas pipelines. But to say what you were talking about, Chris, about is it more beneficial to go to a rich private school versus a university? I would say, go back to what we're saying, like the only reason why it's better to go to a rich private school, even though you're blowing through a shit ton of money, is because the contacts you're going to make there are with people who are rich and they own the companies that, you know, so if you meet some guy whose dad owns an accountant firm or a law firm and you want to be a lawyer, and they're going to pay, you know, 6 figures starting out versus some podunk law school that you went to university and you're getting paid 60 grand a year, like you're the investment's better, but you're going to be more in debt.
Most of my friends from India, because I mean, you forget there's 1.3 billion people there, and most of them are in poverty. So if they're raised with any kind of standards, like they're like, look, this world is tough, you're going to be educated. So there's no choice to them. It's like you're either going to be a lawyer, a doctor, an engineer, and you're going to get one of those three first before you can even think about becoming who you're going to be. Because my friend Neil, he is a doctor and he's an engineer. And his wife is also an engineer, and I think she might be a lawyer. So, like, I mean, that's what I mean. Like, they just overeducate, so they have all their bases covered. But they also learn. They think of our education system as a joke. Like, basically, they said, like, from grad school and PhD, your education is really good in the United States.
We no longer have PE anymore. I don't get that.
Well, I mean, it's just because, like, they learn, like, trigonometry in, like, eighth grade. And I'd never even learned trigonometry. There's so much more that they push themselves to learn to be prepared. Whereas in us, it's like I'm failing geometry in my sophomore year of high school. Like, what do you mean you don't know what a triangle is?
I haven't had a roommate in 12 years. So, but like I couldn't stand it. It's different when you actually have a relationship with that person because you're getting benefits. But you said this is your ex, so I don't know if you're going down that road or not. But I'm a very clean and organized person, and I try to keep stuff brand new if I buy something, because I was the second child and I got a lot of hand-me-down toys and things, and it's usually tore up when you get it. And
well, you should have had me as a grandfather.
Yeah, well, it's just true, because like, you know, you don't get a lot of new things, so when you do get something new, you want to take care of it. And so when you get a roommate or a girlfriend who doesn't do things the way you do it, it's definitely an adjustment period. Because I know, like, my ex, I don't mind a live-in animal. I don't really like cats. I'd rather have a dog. I don't mind a dog in the place, but she always insisted on the dog sleeping in the bed with us, and that drove me insane. Because I don't mind a dog on the bed. I just don't want it in the bed. Because you got hair and shit everywhere in there. And you're just like, oh.
Wait, so it's in the covers?
In the covers, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that drove me nuts.
Like, her only comeback was like, well, I like to cuddle with him. And I'm like, that's what I'm for. I mean, come on.
Oh, you like a cuddle?
I know. I mean, I'm like any normal person. Like, if once you get in bed, you might cuddle for a minute or two. And go to your side, and I go to my side.
Is that dog in the bed in all times? Like, is that dog watching during specific things? Or are you just mostly in the kitchen?
The kitchen was a different girlfriend. That girlfriend, no, like it just sleeping time is when the dog would join us. No one wants a cold nose in the ass when you're trying to go at it. Well, you got, I mean, it depends on, like, is this person giving you half rent? Is this person, what are they contributing? Because if they're just there mooching off you, then you got to set some ground rules of like, look, this is my place. I'm paying for it all. If you break something, you replace it.
Right.
You
know? Exactly.
Because, like, I know, like, my college roommates, I understand when you're in college, you are living on a very tight budget. Like, but if you're living with somebody and you go buy, like, a 6 roll of good Charmin toilet paper, and then they come back the next month with 4 rolls of shitty Walmart brand paper, that's like, I want to fucking kill you. Because it's like, I'm not wiping my ass with this just rough, god-awful toilet paper. I agree that, like, the house should be a joint thing, as in, like, it should be some of your taste, should be some of her taste. But, you know, it depends on the kind of person you are and how you're raised, because you're supposed to be an adult, too. And my idea of a man cave is not necessarily, like, you look at Jay's man cave, of Jay and Jack, his is his toys from his childhood. And there's nothing wrong with having kids, I mean, toys from the 80s out in your living room, but I know a lot of women don't want that. They're like, you know, you're an adult, be an adult and have the things out for the public and our guests to see that reflect us now, not who we were when we were kids. And that's how I see a man cave. Because I've got stuff that I think is pretty cool and it's very me. And if my wife was like, no, I hate that, you can't go in our house, I'd kind of be like, well, fuck you. You know, I'm not saying I'd break up with her or anything about it, but it's just like, you know, this is part of me and you're married me. And you get to pick that really tacky shit that you like. I can pick my tacky shit. Yeah, like, I mean, where I grew up, you just grew up with different kinds of guns. You know, you have some for hunting and then some for self-defense and then some. The thing that's famous in my hometown is Dixie Gunworks, which is an antique. It's like World War II and older company. And my grandmother's worked there since 1955. And so I just grew up around guns. I mean, they're not a big deal to me. I mean, and you're taught from a young age to respect them. And yeah, kind of like what Tim was saying, like, you don't load it unless you're going to use it. You don't cock the hammer unless you're going to shoot something. You don't aim it at anybody. You don't aim it at yourself, especially. I mean, like I said, I hunted birds and deer and turkey and everything my life. So you just, there's different ways to use guns. Well, and like, yeah, and that's one of the things that really shocks me out here in California is how people freak out so easily about guns. And they think, and it's because they didn't grow up around them. They don't understand them. And I get that, but it's like, it's not like every Southerner or Midwest person is just like a gun toting idiot going like, I have a gun in the back of my truck and I'm going to shoot you. You know, it's just, no, it's crazy. Yeah. Like, one of my fraternity brothers, he grew up in a private school in the middle of Nashville and there's no need for learning how to shoot guns. Or when he came to West Tennessee to like wedding stuff, we were like, hey, we're like, we'll show you like these different kinds of guns. And now he's one of the biggest duck hunters I know. Like he moved to West Tennessee from Nashville. Like it's all he does now is hunt. And it's just a thing that guys like to do, because a lot of it is because, you know, we don't have a lot of sports like the big cities do, where you'll have like guys in their 30s, basketball leagues or whatever. And it's kind of a way to get away from your wives and just go and socialize more than anything else. It's guys' time. That's what it is. Because, I mean, I've hunted different things, and there's things I prefer hunting more than others. But most of the time, the reason why I enjoy it is because I'm out there with a bunch of guys of different ages, and we're just shooting the shit, kind of like we're doing right now in this podcast. It's a natural feeling, though, to feel guilt when you kill something anyway, if you're going to eat it or not eat it, regardless. And because I know that when I've gone pheasant hunting in South Dakota, you know, you'll wing, and it's like a big flying chicken. That's what it is. And sometimes you'll just nick them or wing them or whatever, and they're flopping on the ground, and you have to kill it because it can't fly anymore after that. And so, like, my dad will pick it up and wring its neck like you would any chicken. Whereas in me, it's like, I don't want to break the chicken's neck. It makes me feel bad, you know? And so I'll just, like, step on its head, and, like, that does it just as quickly as well. As a single man, it's hard to eat proper. because, like, why do you go buy a crap ton of vegetables or a crap ton of fruit? Because it's just going to go to waste. And one of the girls I work with, she's a little petite. And so she was like, oh, she goes, you know what you need to do? You need to go on Blue Apron and join that. And I was like, okay, what's that? And she sent me a free week of food with, yeah, it's great. And so I like it because I get a box of food every week and it gives you instructions and you make your own food and it's somewhat healthy. So it's perfect. Yeah, I totally agree, though, with crockpot cooking. One that I made at least once a week through college because it's just so simple was just go get buy some kielbasa, a can of green beans, a can of carrots, a can of potatoes, like sliced potatoes, throw in a crockpot for 20, 30 minutes. You're good to go because all the juice, the grease from the kielbasa bleeds into the vegetables, and it's just heaven. And it's simple. It's very simple. These are some tips for those single men out there listening, okay? You need to at least know one good thing to make because yeah. – You get that lady back to your place and you can make something, it's just gold.
You're a keeper.
Yeah, you're a keeper. Yeah, you can do something. Mine, I would say, is I get a 3-pound pork shoulder from the grocery store and I have my, I can't make it Memphis style because I don't have a smoker. So I make it more a Kansas City style. I get a bunch of seasons and I rub it into the meat, the pork shoulder, and I let it sit for overnight. And then I bake it, I think 200, sorry, because it had to be slow. 200 for 7 hours. And that thing is just unbelievable. Then I make my mashed potatoes, which I came up with in college, usually some kind of greens, most of the time asparagus or green beans, and then cornbread. And I that's like my favorite.
What's your mashed potatoes? I mean,
it's really just a baked potato, which you would normally put on a baked potato. But I usually get two either red skin or two new potatoes per person. I boil them till the skin breaks. Then I mash them up with skin and all. But
you spend a lot of time on your meals.
I do. I drain the water out, mash them up, then throw in sour cream, butter, garlic, salt, and salt. And it's all by taste. I mean, by feel. I can't, you know, tell you what. And then it's heaven. It's the best mashed potatoes ever.
That's awesome. That sounds delicious.
It does sound good. That's a lot of work, though.
But yeah, I'll give Boston a tip. Like, so if you make mashed potatoes and since you're in a breakfast kick, if you make mashed potatoes one night and you have like a little bit left over that you're like, oh, these are going to go to waste or I'll throw them out. No, keep them and then get some Bisquick, mix the Bisquick in with mashed potatoes, throw those things on the skillet and you've got potato cakes and those are awesome.
That is awesome.
If you grow up in the South, everything that's green is soaked in ham cooked in ham or bacon grease. It's just the way it is. I went to school, grad school, with five guys from Saudi Arabia, and they said, you know, we would like to come to the South. I was like, well, great, but you're going to starve to death. And they're like, what do you mean? Like, because everything's made with pork. And they're like, really? I'm like, yeah, really? Okay, I was gonna say, like, I don't have any movie stories, but, like, I am that guy, though, at concerts, because they asked about concerts. Because I tend to go to see the baby boomer generation because they're getting to where most of them are stopped touring now or they're about to die. And so I'll go see, you know, Paul McCartney. I'll go see Paul Simon. I'll go see – I'll spring for the good seats. You know, like I'll get the first or second row or whatever of some guy because, like, I want to see him.
Well, because you're single.
I'm single. So I guess you get the one ticket instead of two or three. And it's like, shit, that's $400 or $500, you know, but I like to stand at concerts because, you know, an artist wants you to be standing and dancing and into their music. But a lot of the older generation will just sit quietly, respectfully and watch them perform. And that's it. And so I get a lot of these, can you sit down, please? You know, tapping on the back, like, we're all sitting. Can you sit? And I'm like, I don't want to sit. Yeah, I just paid, you know. And so, like, I feel that makes me feel like an asshole. And I don't like being the asshole, even though apparently I'm the asshole on this podcast. Did I ever tell you that? Like, my assist, not our manager, but, like, he's kind of our manager / security guy of my building. He was Arnold Schwarzenegger's bodyguard from 88 through, like, 96 or 97. He's from Buenos Aires, and he's probably, I would bet he's probably, like, 61, 62, somewhere in there. Of age now, and he's jacked. Yeah, he looks like Arnold now. Like, Arnold's still big, but he's not like muscle bound. You know,
no, he's not toned.
Yeah, and I mean, I wouldn't pick a fight with him. No, but he says that, like, Arnold never had any kind of political aspirations. He says it's really Shriver said that she was the kind of the one that made him run. And was always, you know, like, because she's the Kennedy family. She wanted to.
My good friend, Maria Shriver, she follows me on Twitter.
his presidency, like a lot of presidencies, will be defined in the first 100 days. And exactly, like he will do just enough to fulfill his promises. So, like, you know, building a wall. He's not going to build a wall. Like, me and Tim were talking about this. He'll build sections of it that are, like, really like a big hole in the border, but not physically possible for him to build a wall, like a great wall of China. He's not going to deport 12 million people. It's just, you know, and so people, and I said this earlier on our private Facebook message, people don't understand the power of the executive branch. Yes, it sucks that right now the Republicans both have the House and the Senate and the presidency, but, you know, you have to work together. And the presidency, his power is only veto power and executive orders. That's it. And his only job is to, if the Congress passes a bullshit law, that's his job, is to veto it, saying you forgot about the minority population. That's it. That's his only job. Yeah, they've been showing a lady on the news all day today out here in California holding up a sign saying there will be losses on both sides. We need to start killing people. Well, this is something jokes aside, this is something I also want to talk about, because you guys are talking about being active, which every citizen should be, because I believe it's your right and it's your duty as a citizen of this country to be active in politics. But what our country has gone astray, I would say since about 96, since the Dole Clinton campaign, is that we no longer have empathy for people of the opposite side. And you don't see, right. All I see every day on Facebook is hate. Well, and I'm sick of it. It's like, you can't call half the country racist. You can't call half and expect a good result. You know, Democrats and Republicans both, you can't sit there and call someone, if I'm literally just trying to understand your position of like why you think you do the way you do, and all of a sudden you call me a racist, are you really going to win me over? No, you're not. And that's what all the country is doing right now. And it pisses me off, because it's like, I love studying human beings. I love understanding what makes them tick, why you think the way you do. Win me over. Win. And that's what we're no longer doing that. It's just like, no, my side's this side. I'm correct. You're a fucking idiot. And it's not right. There was five counties, like two in Pennsylvania, three in Ohio, that kept pointing out, said these five counties went overwhelmingly for Obama in both of his elections, and then they went pro-Trump this one. You can't call those people racist. They're looking out for their jobs. They're trying to find a solution to them make money. Yeah. Wages have been stagnant for 16 years. I mean, and costs are going up, and the whole country is bleeding.
Yeah.
Yes, it sucks for the Democratic people who want a lot of social justice, and I understand that. It's like, but a lot of people will just hate the economy of the country right now.
Yeah,
and I'm not justifying the election of either one of these candidates, but it's just like no one knows what to do right now. Also, if you're born in 1990 or 88, you know, or later, you didn't know Clinton because you were too young. The only president you knew was Bush, who was one of the most hated presidents in history, and then Obama, who had this message of hope and this positivity around him, even though he didn't accomplish much because he had a Republican Congress. It's just like, that's all you've known. So all you've known is hate for one party and love for the other. I'm a big fan of tough love, even though that's not really tough love, but I'm the same way. I'm 6'2". I always buy, if I can, the emergency row seat, because I have long legs and you don't have any space. And that happened to me maybe 2 years ago, where I always get the aisle, emergency row, and it was a husband and wife, and I totally understood, but they were young, and the guy walked up to me and was like, "Oh, my wife's sitting next to you. Can I take your seat?" I said, "Where are you sitting?" And the same thing as Jack. And he was sitting next to the window. I said, "No." I was like, and it was behind me. So I was like, "No, I paid for the emergency row and I pay for the aisle because I have long legs." And he just kind of looks at me and goes, "Yeah, but I want to sit next to my wife." I was like, "Well, yeah." And I was like, "No." I was like, "I'm sorry." I was like, "I'm not going to move because that's going to make me uncomfortable. And this is a 5-hour flight." And he's like, "Why are you being a dick?" And I'm just like, "What?" Dude. Yeah. And I'm like, "Like, I'm not being a dick. Why don't you just get your wife to switch with the person sitting next to you? You know, like I'm not moving." The things that I've been noticing in the last couple of years that are pissing me off is people, because like now you have to pay to check your luggage in. So everyone's carrying on now. But a lot of people that are sitting in the back of the plane, when they're getting on, they're putting their carry-ons in the first few rows right there above them. And then so they can walk in the back. So when they get up, all their luggage is up in the front of the plane, so they don't have to carry it. So it fills up the entire front part of the plane. And if I'm sitting in the front part of the plane, I'm like, where the fuck am I supposed to stick my luggage? And then they go, "Well, you can put it on the plane for you, or you can put it in the back," which makes me have to walk to the back of the plane. And it's like, you fucking dickheads. I always laugh to myself when I'm in the beginning part of the plane, when you sit down, the whole stewardess or flight attendant comes on now and does the whole, like, you know, "In case of emergency, please put the thing over your face and breathe normally."
And it's that word when they say breathe normally that just makes me die laughing in the middle of the plane. Because it's like, that's the last thing I'm doing in that situation is breathing normally. You know, like I'm about to crash into a mountain. That happened, not to constantly look, because I feel like I'm doing this now, like telling my story. Like that happened to me 11 years ago on a flight to China, a 15-hour flight. I get on the flight, and the woman next to me is a very large African-American woman. And the one thing I do like about large black ladies is that they're usually extremely nice and sweet. And so I sit down, and I'm already nervous because I've never flown 15 hours before. So I take a handful of Dramamine, and I just pass the fuck out. And I'm in the middle of the three-wide thing. And I wake up, and I'm literally, like, she's my pillow. I'm just completely,
yes,
like, you're into snuggling. Her. I'm snuck. Basically, I'm snuck because she took up half of my seat. So I'm sitting, like, crooked like this, you know, and kind of, like, enter. And I finally come to, and I'm, of course, I'm laying on top of her. You know, and she looks at me, and she goes, oh, honey, baby, it's okay. I'm just like a large pillow, you know. Like, and she just, I mean, and we were like best friends after that because she's like, I know I'm comfy, you know. <it's> just,
But the Graceland is a destination I want to go to.
Okay.
No? Why? What's wrong with
things that, okay.
Is it a letdown?
Yeah, it's a letdown. Graceland, it's in a really rough neighborhood now in Memphis. It's like, one, it's a time capsule. It has not been changed since 1977. But what's sad about that is not that it's decked out full of 70 stuff. It's the fact that it's if someone never had money their entire life and then got a lot of money, that's what their house looks like. It's just full of shit and tacky shit everywhere that doesn't match. And you're like, who the hell decorated this place? It makes no sense.
Well, it was Elvis, right?
It's Elvis, yeah.
He had more money than he could spend, right?
Well, he got 49% of everything he ever earned. The colonel got 51%. Jesus.
That was a good deal for the colonel.
Oh, yeah, but the colonel kind of ruined his career in a lot of ways because he dictated,
the movies.
The movies, yeah, and songs and... Actually, I don't really know a lot about that. Like, apparently, like a colonel, I'm not sure where he got his title, but like, it doesn't take much to become a colonel in Kentucky. Like, it's some honor that you can just pay and you get that title.
Really?
Yeah.
So if I moved to Kentucky, I could be a colonel.
You could. It could be Colonel Glatfelder. That's nice. That's a mouthful.
All right, so we're like an hour in. Nick, I don't think you've told your stories yet.
About what?
Your week? Anything?
Like any... No, not really.
you're not coming to the podcast.
No, I'll tell you. Okay, like on Friday, I went and saw John Bryan play. Who is he's a musician who mostly does soundtracks. He did like Magnolia and Eternal Sunshine, Spotless Mind, and I Heard Huckabees. And I mean, he's a really multi-talented musician. He doesn't sing a lot, but like he came out and he said, "Oh, before I perform, I have a few guys that want to do their comedy sketch before I play."
Can I interrupt you? Were you on a date?
I was not on a date.
Okay.
I go to a lot of shows by myself because I actually want to listen to the music. Whereas when I'm on a date, I feel like I have to talk, and then I'm like, "Why the fuck am I even? Why did I pay money to come see a show when I'm talking?" It ended up being the two hosts of the Independent Spirit Film Awards, and they came out and did their entire monologue and all the cut-tos from commercials. And one of them was, he was like, oh, and now presenting the award for blah, 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 blah is this person and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And all of a sudden, this person just comes running out of the crowd. It's a very small theater and jumps up on stage, and it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Really?
What the hell? Wow. Yeah. And he was sitting a couple of rows behind me in the place. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. And then, of course, they were shocked as well. And they're like, only in L.A. when you actually announce someone, they're actually in – they could be in the crowd.
Nice.
And, yeah, it was nice. And then John came out and played. And it was interesting because as a soundtrack, it's kind of like going to see, John Williams or Giacchino or anything else. Like, he actually showed you, like, how he makes his music. And then he did a lot of covers too, which was nice. But so he would have these two screens behind him, and he would play 20 seconds of he'd have a video clip of just somebody drumming, and then he would isolate 20 seconds of it and put it on a loop. And then he would take a clip of a symphony or some dialogue of a movie and stick it in there and then have it on a loop. And then he would start playing piano, put it on a loop, then get guitar out, put it on a loop. You know, and like he would show you how he makes all these effects. And I was like, that's just really freaking cool, man. Like just, it was pretty interesting. And then every now and then, you know, people, he realized that would take time. And then he would be like, all right, somebody throw out a request. And he would just, they would say any song and he'd play it. But he'd play it the way he would play it. And So it was pretty neat. And that was a pretty interesting. And then Sunday, there was a George Harrison expo a few blocks north of me. So I checked that out and saw a lot of handwritten lyrics and some artifacts of George Harrison's. Which George Harrison, if people don't know, like George Harrison is like my favorite musician of all time. So
your favorite Beatle.
He's my favorite Beatle, and yeah, because I mean, it's one of those things you can debate. But like George, to me, is, I mean, even though Paul and John wrote and like kind of have all the glory, without George, the Beatles would not have been the Beatles. It was a pretty good weekend, and then like this last 2 days, I had an application I had to make, a web application, and it was stressful for me getting the code right and getting it online, and it got done around 5:30 today, and so I came straight here and got some beer and talking to you guys.